The 14th and 15th century saw the building of numerous Gothic town churches and town halls throughout Europe, which still in many cases serve their original purpose. The power and prosperity of the towns find their best expression in these and in the fortifications with their strong towers and gateways. Every picture of a town of the 16th or later centuries shows conspicuously these latter erections for the protection and honour of the town. The town did many things which in our time are done by the state. Social problems were taken up by town administration or the corresponding municipal organisation. The regulation of trade was the concern of the guilds in agreement with the council. The care of the poor belonged to the church, while the council looked after the protection of the town walls and the very necessary fire brigade. The council, mindful of its social duties, superintended the filling of the municipal granaries in order to have supplies in years of scarcity. Such storehouses were erected in almost every town during the 15th century. Tariffs of prices for the sale of all wares, high enough to enable every artisan to make a good livelihood and to give the purchaser a guarantee for the quality of the wares, were maintained. The town was also the chief capitalist. As a seller of annuities on lives and inheritances, it was a banker and enjoyed unlimited credit. In return, it obtained means for the construction of fortifications or for such occasions as the acquisition of sovereign rights from the hand of an impecunious prince. For the most part, these European towns were independent or quasi-independent aristocratic republics. Most admitted a vague overlordship on the part of the church, or of the emperor, or of a king. Others were parts of kingdoms, or even the capitals of dukes or kings. In such cases, their internal freedom was maintained by a royal or imperial charter. In England, the royal city of Westminster on the Thames stood cheek by jowl with the walled city of London, into which the king came only with ceremony and permission. The entirely free Venetian Republic ruled an empire of dependent islands and trading ports, rather after the fashion of the Athenian Republic. Genoa also stood alone. The Germanic towns of the Baltic and North Sea, from Riga to Middelburg in Holland, Dortmund and Cologne, were loosely allied in a confederation, the Confederation of the Hansa Towns, under the leadership of Hamburg, Bremen and Lübeck, a confederation which was still more loosely attached to the empire. This confederation, which included over 70 towns in all, and which had depots in Novgorod, Bergen, London, and Bruges, did much to keep the northern seas clean of piracy, that curse of the Mediterranean and of the eastern seas. The Eastern Empire, throughout its last phase, from the Ottoman conquest of its European hinterland in the 14th and early 15th century until its fall in 1453, was practically only the trading town of Constantinople, a town-state like Genoa or Venice, except that it was encumbered by a corrupt imperial court. The fullest and most splendid developments of this city life of the late Middle Ages occurred in Italy. After the end of the Hohenstaufen line in the 13th century, the hold of the Holy Roman Empire upon North and Central Italy weakened. Although, as we shall tell, German emperors were still crowned as kings and emperors in Italy up to the time of Charles V, around 1530. There arose a number of quasi-independent city-states to the north of Rome, the papal capital. South Italy and Sicily, however, remained under foreign dominion. Genoa and her rival, Venice, were the great trading seaports of this time. Their noble palaces, their lordly paintings, still win our admiration. Milan, at the foot of the St. Gotthard Pass, revived to wealth and power. Inland was Florence, a trading and financial centre, which under the almost monarchical rule of the Medici family in the 15th century enjoyed a second Periclean age. But already before the time of these cultivated Medici bosses, Florence had produced much beautiful art. Giotto's tower, Giotto born 1266, died in 1337, and the Duomo by Brunellesco, born 1377 and died in 1446, already existed. Towards the end of the 14th century, Florence became the centre of the rediscovery, restoration, and imitation of antique art, the Renaissance in its narrower sense. Artistic productions, unlike philosophical thought and scientific discovery, are the ornaments and expression rather than the creative substance of history, and here we can't attempt to trace the development of the art of Filippo Lippi, Botticelli, Donatello, who died in 1466, Leonardo da Vinci, who died in 1519, Michelangelo, who lived from 1475 to 1564, and Raphael, who died in 1520. Of the scientific speculation of Leonardo, we've already had occasion to speak. 8. In 1453, as we've related, Constantinople fell. Throughout the next century, the Turkish pressure upon Europe was heavy and continuous. The boundary line between Mongol and Aryan, which had lain somewhere east of the Pamirs in the days of Pericles, had receded now to Hungary. Constantinople had long been a mere island of Christians in a Turk-ruled Balkan peninsula. Its fall did much to interrupt the trade with the East. Of the two rival cities of the Mediterranean, Venice was generally on much better terms with the Turks than Genoa. Every intelligent Genoese sailor fretted at the trading monopoly of Venice and tried to invent some way of getting through it or round it. And there were now new peoples taking to the sea trade and disposed to look for new ways to the old markets because the ancient routes were closed to them. The Portuguese, for example, were developing an Atlantic coasting trade. The Atlantic was waking up again after a vast period of neglect that dated from the Roman murder of Carthage. It's rather a delicate matter to decide whether the Western European was pushing out into the Atlantic or whether he was being pushed out into it by the Turk, who lorded it in the Mediterranean until the Battle of Lepanto in 1571. The Venetian and Genoese ships were creeping round to Antwerp, and the Hansa town seamen were coming south and extending their range, and there were considerable developments of seamanship and shipbuilding in progress. The Mediterranean is a sea for galleys and coasting, but upon the Atlantic Ocean and the North Sea, winds are more prevalent, seas run higher, the shore is often a danger rather than a refuge. The high seas called for the sailing ship, and in the 14th and 15th centuries it appears keeping its course by the compass and the stars. By the 13th century, the Hansa merchants were already sailing regularly from Bergen across the grey cold seas to the Northmen in Iceland. In Iceland, men knew of Greenland, and adventurous voyagers had long ago found a further land beyond, Vinland, where the climate was pleasant and where men could settle if they chose to cut themselves off from the rest of humankind. This Vinland was either Nova Scotia or, what's more probable, New England. All over Europe in the 15th century, merchants and sailors were speculating about new ways to the east. The Portuguese, unaware that Pharaoh Necho had solved the problem ages ago, were asking whether it wasn't possible to go round to India by the coast of Africa. Their ships followed in the course that Hanno took to Cape Verde in 1445. They put out to sea to the west and found the Canary Isles, Madeira, and the Azores. That was a fairly long stride across the Atlantic. In 1486, a Portuguese, Diaz, reported that he had rounded the south of Africa.